us the permanent rules. And I think that we'll start with an explanation, and then we'd be open, and we can discuss as we go, and then open up for amendments if necessary at the end of the explanation. But Senator Fischbach has been really taking a lead on this. And so, Senator Fischbach, would you like to begin with
the chair? What would be your preference? Shall I explain from here, or would you prefer me at the...
Actually, right from here is fine. And then we do have some testifiers today, so.
All right. Madam Chair, members, I think you have the copy in front of you now. The most recent copy is the 6:30 p.m. on the 28th. So that's the one I'll be using. I think that's in your packets. I will go through and reference page numbers. Some of them are very simple changes, and then some may require a little more explanation. But on those rules, on page 2 at the bottom, there are some name changes so that the names meet up with the new names of the committees. That is also the case on the top of page 3. Middle to top of page 4, there is a reference to committees other than, so that that lines up with our new committee names. But then there is also a designation on who would be announcing the targets. In the past, there hasn't we haven't explained who makes those announcements. So now the chair of the Committee on Finance or the chair of the Committee on Rules and Administration would be able to make those announcements. The next changes, and just stop me if there's questions on those specific areas. The next changes appear on page 6, and the bulk of it is on 6.20 through 6.23, and what that was a requiring of a creation of a uniform criteria. And Senator Bach, as you recall, we weren't sure when we met on that. There wasn't a real clarity on what the uniform criteria was or if anybody had used it, so we removed that portion. But the process regarding committee assignments of the majority providing the minority with information regarding the numbers on each committee is still provided for in Rules 10.1 and 10.2. Then there's some renumbering and name changing there in the removing and budget divisions. And then down in Rule 10.4, the new 10.4, excuse me, it removes that portion of the term limit that would add the extra 2 years when it ends in a... when it ends on that redistricting time, so that they would only serve 8 years instead of 10. Oh, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, doesn't it state 3 terms, so wouldn't it still be 10 years rather than 12?
Oh, maybe you're right.
Stays 3.
Council.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I'm sorry, my math was, it's just a math issue, not a...
Mr. Bodden, is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, that's right.
I'm sorry. I'll use a calculator next time.
I'm not going to say anything.
Madam Chair, then the following number or the following changes are then on page 7, and there are some name changes there, but then there is also removing the necessity for the Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and St. Louis County delegations to be open to the public. As we move down into 12.2, this language clarifies that a violation of the open meeting law complaint, or a complaint on that violation, must be made in writing. And there was, because it was kind of strange that a member of the Senate could do it either orally or in writing, but the public had to do it in writing. So everybody has to make it in writing if there's a complaint on that open meeting law.
Madam Chair, that wouldn't preclude somebody that felt like they were witnessing a violation of the open meeting law to voicing that orally and kind of saying, you know, I intend to file a written complaint kind of during business hours. As we checked into that, it sounded like the reason orally was in there so that somebody could officially object at the time something was happening rather than maybe the next day. Oftentimes those happen late at night or nobody's watching. But.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bach, it's in no way to preclude that kind of putting someone on notice. But I think that, I think that people are concerned that if the things be in writing so that we know it's clear what the concern is, what the complaint is, and there's no question that a complaint has been filed, so that it just makes clarity for the complaint, but it would in no way preclude anyone from at a committee, at a meeting, saying, hey, I think you're violating the open meeting law here. I plan on.
Senator Fishbaugh?
I'm moving on, Madam Chair, to the lower part there. On lines 728 and 729, what that does is removes the ability in committee to consider a bill that was introduced on that day. This had the exception of a two-thirds votes by the members of the committee. That's removed, but in reality, you could still suspend the rules if you needed to. This addresses just a committee or just a bill in committee that was introduced that day.
And Senator Fishbaugh, what is the requirement for suspending the rules?
Two-thirds.
The two-thirds. So it's essentially the same standard, or it is the same standard.
And then on page 8, at the top, it changes the time that you would need to vote in committee to meet past to midnight. It used to be at 10 p.m., but if to meet past midnight, you would require a two-thirds vote of the members present. Then there's some name changes and some ands and some ors that were added to make it flow correctly. And then down at the very bottom of page 8, it changes the time the Senate will convene from 10 to 11, because 11 is actually when we have been convening. So that's a simple change. There's nothing on page 9. And on page 10, 10.3 removes the president's ability to admit a head of the Department of State or a Department of the State Government, so a commissioner or something like that, to be admitted to the floor. It just seemed like we didn't really need to have department commissioners on the floor of the Senate, and I guess I had never really seen any necessity where that became a necessity to admit someone to the floor. On the new rule 15.6, we did add a little language that would allow for the chaplain, for the president to admit the chaplain and the pledge of who would be leading the Pledge of Allegiance, because we became aware that there wasn't an exception to that when we did make the change for the Pledge of Allegiance, and realized that there wasn't even an exception for someone to say the prayer. So we're adding that so that we are able to admit those people.
So
I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Fishbaugh, is the word prayer broad enough, or are we going to hear some discussion about that? And I don't personally know, but. Winnie?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach,
I'm not aware of anything. I just kind of want, these are kind of always kind of sensitive issues. So I
think that is what we have called it. We could, I suppose, if needed be, we could provide for the chaplain of the day, which is what we officially call that person. But if it did become an issue, we could probably take a look at the exact
language. In the event
somebody
raises something, because I know these are always pretty sensitive.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Fishbaugh.
Madam Chair, actually, Rule 16 is there's significant changes there, and it's actually three pages. And I think that we had some testifiers who would be willing to explain that, who were much more involved in the writing of this and the decisions on this than I was.
Okay, so at this time, members, what I would do is invite David Brower, who is a writer from MinnPost, and Mr. Mitch Berg, writer from blog Shot in the Dark, to the table. And this was a small working group that was put together to address credentialing, trying to bring some fairness to the process, taking out some of the partisan, as well as recognizing members of the new media. So, gentlemen, thank you for coming to the committee, and whoever wants to start.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Mitch Berg, and from 9 to 5, I'm a mild-mannered IT usability engineer. But between 5:30 and 7 in the morning, I write a blog, Shot in the Dark, and Saturdays from 1 to 3, I do a little talk show at a fire-breathing conservative talk station in Eagan. I could be fairly called a conservative, and probably even more fairly called an obstreperous conservative at that. However, I was asked here not so much to make a partisan inroad into the system as to represent for the alternative media, the new media that has sprung up since the Senate rules were first created, and more specifically for the idea that the definition of journalist no longer necessarily means someone with an office at 425 Portland or 7th and Cedar or one of the other traditional media outlets. Here in Minnesota, we've been at the forefront of the new media, making inroads into how information is disseminated and how the media has been democratized over this last 10 years here. The road to removing Dan Rather from the evening news, to quote an example, started in someone's bedroom in Eagan when Scott Johnson sat up and wrote the story that led to that event. And since then, we've had quite a number of people whose pedigrees don't necessarily stack up like a traditional Capitol reporter, but who bring a passion and a knowledge and a depth of knowledge about any number of issues. Speed Gibson and Matt Abe about education, Sheila Kinney about local taxes, the uptake about a variety of other issues on both sides, really both sides and no side of the political spectrum. And yet, while these people are able right now to bring a level of if nothing else, specialty of expertise to a lot of topics and clarity and transparency to these subjects that just because of the nature of the beast, traditional reporters can't, they don't get treated like traditional like establishment reporters do. That's something we'd like to see change here. So basically I was invited to this working group here along with David to help reach a definition of journalist that would open up the field and reflect the new democratization of the media. And that's really what we're here for on a thoroughly nonpartisan basis. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Mr. Brown?
Mitch covered most of my points, but I'd just like to say thank you, especially to the committee staff and to Sergeant-at-Arms Lindquist for his participation in this. It made it very easy. It was professional. I was impressed with the idea of removing partisanship, partisan considerations, government review of speech, really, from the rules, putting that into the nonpartisan staff. I'm very happy. One of our advisors was a law professor at the University of Minnesota who suggested an appeals process, which we'll put it back before your committee, I believe. I think that's a great structure. I'm also very happy that these will be platform neutral in the future. I think we all know that we consume and participate in media through a number of devices, both traditional print, TV, radio, and all of the new platforms that are coming. And these rules really make no discrimination toward how you do your journalism. So really, in short, I just want to say thank you, and I welcome any of your questions.
Members, any questions? Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, who else was on this working group that is being referred to?
It comprised of the gentleman before you, as well as Mr. Lindquist with the Sergeant-at-Arms office. And who else was on?
Madam Chair, we also had Colin Sheehan from the majority and Bo Berenson, I believe, from the minority side.
Oh, thank you. Michael. Oh, and Mr. Broadcorb from the majority.
That's right.
So Madam Chair, do we know how the people now that are specifically given passes feel about this? I mean, the Star Tribunes of the world. And
Mr. Brower?
Madam Chair, our understanding is that even though I didn't talk to these people directly, that these have been circulated in the Capitol basement in the press area, and there were no objections. So I think my understanding personally is that the people who have credentials now will keep credentials under this rule, and that there will be new voices who will get credentials that weren't able to in the past.
Thank you.
If I might add, Madam Chair.
Mr. Burke?
Yes. We did take some pains as well to see to it that the investment that some of the establishment media, for example, those who lease space in the basement, have their interests represented in the process here as well. It's not a complete free-for-all in which everyone is on exactly the same playing field as regards getting access to the chamber.
Madam Chair, if I could just
Mr. Brower.
Add to that. Basically what we've done is, in recognition of the fact that the media outlets who already have leases via the Department of Administration in the Capitol press space tend to represent the larger outlets in the state, There are some seats both on the floor and in a new press gallery that's being created in the balcony. There's some spaces that are reserved for those organizations. And then because we're creating more seats, in effect, there will also be seats that will be available on a first-come, first-served basis to anybody, really, be they traditional or new media.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, so that covers Rule 16, and then we will go to page 12 under decorum. There, at the bottom of 12, there is we have added the dress code, which has always been tradition, but we have added it here into the rules in writing. And Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, I was reading that, and I was wondering if we need to give the president some discretion here. I mean, I'm just thinking maybe of we may have somebody from the military that might want to lead the pledge in their military uniform that wouldn't be permitted under this. Is there some, you know, if they wanted to come in their fatigues, I think the president should maybe have some discretion to allow them to do that.
Well,
I'm not wed to anything specific. I'm just think the president maybe might want a little discretion in the event something comes up.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bach, if in general, if nobody objects to a rule, if we had a gentleman come on in fatigues or a lady come on in fatigues and nobody objected, it would be the rule would be considered suspended and they would be allowed. So that is where you would, you know, kind of get the discretion as long as no, and that's why we had, we were able to have the chaplain and the people come on to lead the pledge because no one objected. If someone objects, then you have to enforce the rule. So, I mean, if you would feel more comfortable to provide giving me more discretion, that's fine. That's
well, I think
Senator Bach.
I mean, the reason we have rules, I would expect the president enforces the rules and doesn't just ignore them because nobody objects. It just seems like some discretion for the president might be appropriate, I think, rather than just ignoring it. You know, the rule's the rule. And
Senator Madam Fischbach. Chair, Senator Bach, I am absolutely with you on a rule as a rule, but I'm just saying that if there was, in those special circumstances where there was someone that we would want, you know, someone in Marine dress blues would not be wearing a tie. but certainly an appropriate outfit to wear on the Senate floor. And so I think in that would be the case. We're not going to ignore the rules, but in those very specific special cases, as long as that nobody would object. But if you would feel more comfortable with us putting some kind of, if Mr. Bodern can come up with something quickly, but.
Mr. Bodern has potentially a suggestion.
Madam Chair and members,
Mr. Bodern.
It's pretty hard to do this in a way that would, if you want to preserve some discretion for the Senate to do it without making it completely open-ended. One way, one suggestion I have would be that on line 12.31, and you could do this as well on 12.32, after appropriate attire insert includes but is not limited to, so there's some room for definition there. But, you know, that does open it up. Otherwise, if you're going to give the discretion to one member of the body without any further guidance, pretty hard to say, just as determined by the president. If you want to think about it and come back to it, I guess we could do that.
All right, Senator Bach, we'll be open to language changes.
Well, I mean, I think, Madam Chair, if we're going to put this in the rules, I mean, rather than just ignore it, we probably ought to give somebody some discretion.
All right, Senator Fischbach.
All right, Madam Chair. So we'll probably come back to that. The next changes up here on page 16, and 1610 and 1611 just seem to be outdated language. It talked about a bill may not be made a special order if the chief author has declined three previous occasions to take up the bill after it was designated a special order. And I don't know where exactly it came from. But especially generally, we have used a special order that you take it up that day. So if you're declining it three times, there's something going on, and it shouldn't be designated as special order. Next, changes on page 17. These are just some clarifying. We've renumbered it in a sense so that it's easier to understand, or at least I think that the reconsideration is one or two or three, so that it's a little easier instead of having one big paragraph. And then that language on 17-18, it simply states later. It's just a little bit different way to say later after the time period provided under clause one or two. So it's just a little bit clearer language there. And then we've got some renumbering after that. Page 18 at the very bottom, there's some renumbering where, just to make it easier to read, as it's, again, it's that issue of if we have one big paragraph, this just breaks it out a little bit. That flips over onto page 19, and there's a little bit of renumbering in the middle of 19 under germaneness. We've got changes on page 21 in the middle, and this is this would prevent an additional roll call if the electronic voting system is in use. So if we are in the middle of a roll call on the electronic board, then we would not have an oral roll call, say to close the vote or something like that. It does not stop us from, you know, having a voice vote or calling a division. We can still have the vote, just not a roll call. And because once you are using the electronic voting system, the roll call would have to be done by name, by the secretary. So, you know, Anderson, Bach, and wait for response. So that's what that would do. So that language on page 21. The next changes are on page 23, and it's down at toward the bottom, 23.26 and 23.27 and 23.28. And basically this removes language that requires the chair to give priority for consideration to a bill that if the bill has made it to the floor during the first part of the biennium, the first half of the biennium, and then is sent back to committee, it would be given priority in that committee. We thought that would be better to give the chairs the decision on that, and if they wanted to hear the bill again or whatever the case may be, but it would just deal with those bills that had been sent back from the floor. Page 24, at the very bottom, there are some committee name changes and an and things like that, and that is the case on the top of 25. And then on page 26, under the sergeant-at-arms, this is just kind of renumbering and making a little clearer as opposed to the big paragraph. We've separated them out so that the sergeant-at-arms duties are clearer there. And then on page 27, we've added language on 27.17, 18, and 19 that would allow a hearing, an executive session, when an employee may have had a complaint against them, so that there could be an initial executive session. And then it does take a vote of the members of the committee, but we just kind of felt like it might be nice to be able to have executive session available to that committee if there's some employee complaint made.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, is the rule clear that the executive session still would need to be recorded?
Mr. Byrne.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, yes. You can add more language to it if you want, but I believe that would be covered.
Where does it say that?
That is in the general requirements that apply to rules, the rules that cover Senate hearings. I think that'd be under the open meeting provisions, but if you like, I can take some time and find that reference for you.
I think it might be, considering we just had a gap in the tape, the Watergate tape. Might be a good idea and apparently I heard we had 27 other instances. I don't know when they were, but seems worth saying so that there's no implication that somehow we're going to do something there's not a record of.
Senator Fishbach, Senator Zenshin.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering whether or not some cases they need to be taped. Some of these are fairly personal and private, and I'm not sure it's publicly. I'm not sure the public interest is represented sometimes as we might talk about an employee issue.
Senator Zenshin. Mr. Bodden has asked for a minute to prepare some suggested language. Senator Bach, is that all right?
No, that's fine. That's fine. I just, you know, if they're meeting in committee, it just seems like, you know, if Senator Sundrum, if they're having some informal discussion in the cafeteria, that's one thing. But they're meeting in an official executive session and decide to close the meeting. Somebody should know what was said there.
All right. Well, we'll work on some language there too, Senator Bach. Thanks. Senator Fishbach?
Okay, we left out there. On page 27, Madam Chair, on page 27, there's after that employee disciplinary proceeding, there's a name change on the bottom there, and then we move on to page 28. This is in reference to the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct, that an investigation or a complaint must be made in writing. And we tried to make sure that that was clear, that it was by a member of the Senate under oath, so that everything would be clear on exactly how that would happen. And then within 30 calendar days, we added calendar, so it was very clear how long we had to conduct those hearings. On page 29, we tried to clean this up, and I believe that included in your packets, and I can just make sure, there is the statute 10A.07 that's referenced. I think we made copies of those, did we? So those would be available in your packet. But basically that 57, that conflict of interest, is reflected in the statute, the 10A.07. So instead of repeating it, we just made it a little clearer up there in 56, the new 56.4. And so if anybody has any questions, but like I said, that that statute should be in your packet.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I wanted to offer an oral amendment to line 29.7. The new 56.4 references Minnesota statutes, but it also says that the members of the Senate shall disclose potential conflicts of interest in the discharge of senatorial duties. I want to make very clear that whatever is in 56.4 is exactly the same standard as would be in 10A.07. And so I would ask the committee to delete from lines 29.7 the words "under the procedures" and insert instead the word "as." So whatever Minnesota statute section 10A.07 provides by way of a duty to disclose would be provided in our rules.
Okay. Mr. Norman, any everyone understand the oral amendment?
Could you just repeat it?
Certainly. So members, on line 29.7, we will take out the words "under the procedures" and insert the word "as." So it will read "senatorial duties as provided in Minnesota statute section 10A.07.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Fishbach.
Madam Chair, I think that is actually a very helpful amendment and makes things much clearer.
Okay. Madam Chair, what is the chair? What does the chairman of the Judiciary Committee think?
Senator Lemmer?
He's pondering.
Madam Chair, I think that's an appropriate reference.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Lemmer. Any other comments on the oral amendment? All right. All in favor of Senator Ortman's oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
Oh, are we done?
Well, real quick, like
Senator
a bunny.
Fishburne.
Madam Chair, the rest just seems to be either changes, name changes, renumbering, and then some changing the rule references. So I think that, and that covers it all then.
All right. So Senator Gerlach, and then.
Madam Chair, I have just a question. Under the lobby section 57, the new section, lines 29.20, that paragraph there, that 57.2, how do we have jurisdiction over a lobbyist as far as ethical conduct? How do we, what would we do for sanctions? What would we do for hearing? How do we, they're not under our purview. So I know this has been in here for a long time, but I'm just curious, and how do we have jurisdiction over the conduct of a lobbyist?
Well, Senator Gerlach, I obviously don't know the genesis of this, but I noticed that the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct shall investigate a complaint. So there is a procedure that goes through the Ethics Committee to address if there were a complaint in writing under oath.
I'm just asking.
And the same rules.
Not a big deal, Madam Chair. I was just curious. It occurred to me just now as what? Oh.
Senator Gerlach, could you repeat your question for Mr. Bonner?
Certainly, Mr. Bonner and committee members. Under the middle paragraph here under the lobbyist section 57, and it talks about lobbyists shall not knowingly, either directly or indirectly, et cetera, provide false information, et cetera. How do we, as a Senate, have jurisdiction over the conduct of a lobbyist? They're not a member of our body. How do we put rules in place over their ethical conduct? What jurisdiction do we have?
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach,
Mr. Brown.
Part of the question turns on the discipline that the Senate might impose on the lobbyists, and it's not necessarily that they're going to be expelled or anything like that, but possibly reprimanded by the Senate, taken into account if they've appeared before the Senate and perhaps misrepresented something or otherwise misstated it intentionally. Then the Senate may feel it has a duty to take that into account.
Okay, Madam Chair, I don't need to go on. I'm just, has this ever happened?
Yes.
Yeah. It has?
Yes.
Where a lobbyist was, a complaint was filed against a lobbyist within the ethics?
Yes.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, then.
All right, Senator Gerlach. Senator Lemmer, did you have?
Yes, I'd like to introduce an amendment. Madam Chair, if I could direct the committee to turn to page 7. Lines 12 and 13. 12's, or on lines 12 and 13 on page 7, there's a reference. Your striking language of a caucus of the Hennepin County, Ramsey County, or St. Louis County delegation is open to the public. I would like to reinstate that language in our rule. I would not think that there would be any reason for any caucus of those county memberships to meet in private and deny the public from knowing what we do. And if we happen to have a majority of, let's say, a county commission, we might be part and parcel causing them to violate an open meeting law. And so I would like to reinstate the stricken language on lines 12 and 13.
Okay, so Senator Lemmer moves on lines 7.12 and 7.13 to reinstate the language. Any discussion? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, what about other caucuses of the legislature? I mean, why are these three singled out? I do know we have a rural caucus. Could have a majority of members show up at a meeting like that. You know, there's a mental health caucus. There's other caucuses, early childhood caucus. I mean,
Senator Berglund, we were looking into the history of why this was even inserted. I'm not aware of necessarily a St. Louis County delegation caucus that meets. Mr. Bodern, any? I think Senator Bach was going to explore
Madam Chair, we checked with people with historical memories around the building, and nobody can seem to remember why it was put in. But it doesn't mean it wasn't put in for a good reason.
There had to be a reason.
But I'm sure there probably was. May have something to do with St. Louis County.
Yeah, that's what we were blaming it on.
Senator Ortman?
Since I
Senator Mark Arata started the O Caucus many years ago, and we met in private all the time with Senator Olson and
and Madam Chair, there was a Dave Caucus for a while.
Senator Arata.
Well, all right. The motion before us is to reinstate the language. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I have no problem with it. It would have been helpful to maybe find some history of it, but if Senator Limmer is, you know, concerned that that be put back in, that's fine, and we'll blame it on former Senator Johnson only.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, my concern is that by specifying these three groups, that it implies that other groups are not open to the public. And I think if you take this out, then anytime you have a majority of legislators at a meeting, it has to be open to the public. Anytime you have a majority of county commissioners from a county board at a meeting, it has to be open to the public. But you could have those things going on with a different caucus, and by the fact that the rules don't specify that it has to be open to the public, it might be construed that they don't have to be.
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, I'm not 110% sure, but I don't believe that the legislature is subject to the open meeting law of having a majority of legislators have to have a open meeting. I may be wrong on that, but I kind of remember reading something. Maybe council might be able to have a better recollection than mine.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, there is a separate section that provides for the conduct of open meetings for the legislature in Chapter 3. Section 3.055 provides the procedures that would apply to legislative meetings. And I haven't had time to look it up, but I believe you're right. I believe the legislature is specifically exempted from the provisions of the open meeting law.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Just to continue the conversation with Senator Limmer, you know, none of these caucuses, and they really have no standing to do anything other than meet. They may think they have unique powers at times. But I'm not sure it belongs in the Senate rules. You know, we're trying to figure out how to update the Senate rules, and this does seem like kind of a strange reference to three particular clubs. I'm not sure it fits.
Are you asking me a question, Senator Michelle?
Yeah, I'm asking, asking you to consider my opinion.
Your opinion.
Senator Limmer?
Well, maybe I could follow up with or use the same logic that Senator Berglund has suggested, that by taking this language out as is proposed, does that mean that a caucus of legislators, let's say from our county, could have a private meeting and discuss public issues and bar the public from listening in or at least being in the same room? Is that what we want?
Mr. Bodden has.
By its omission in our rules?
Mr.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, looking at the statute, it specifies that meetings of the legislature must be open to the public and then provides some exemptions. And this is, again, Section 3.055. And basically it says not including a caucus of the members of any of those bodies. So they are specifically, a caucus is specifically exempted under the statute. The statute goes on to recognize that the Senate may provide by rule for additional restrictions and limitations on the open meeting requirement.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Bonner, does it...
Senator Michelle?
Does it define what a caucus is?
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle, no.
Mr. Bonner?
Of course we didn't.
All right, members. Are we ready to vote?
Ready.
All right, so all in favor, everyone understands that this would be reinstating the language on signs 7.12 and 7.13. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any further discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have.
Senator Limmer.
try another one. Let me direct you to page 11. And specifically line 14. Now, the way the new language is proposed, this is for session news credentials. An organization or individual must submit an application to the Sergeant at Arms at least 30 days before the first day of the legislative session. I'm wondering if by leaving the words in at least 30 days before the first day of the legislative session, have we not already gone past that date, number one? And number two, what if there's a new news organization that wants to participate in activities and have an application submitted to the Sergeant of Arms for approval? And my suggestion is to remove on line 14 the words at least 30 days before the first day of the legislative session. I think we react fairly quickly to these types of requests, and I don't think we need to have the time parameter that precedes a legislative session.
Okay. So Senator Limmer has moved to delete the language on lines 11.14, at least 30 days before the first day of the legislative session. Is that correct, Senator Limmer?
That's correct.
Discussion on the Limmer amendment.
Madam Chair, it might be helpful Senator to Buck? Hear from the sergeant's office. Hmm. I mean, if the sergeant's office was part of the discussions of putting this whole thing together.
Madam Chair, members Welcome. Of the committee, Sven Lindquist, Senate Sergeant at Arms. To address that question, the days number, and I'm really not that concerned about the number of days, but it's more of an administrative line that allows us to gather the information and per Senate rules then to begin the process of compiling the Senate press booklet that the rules address. So I can understand how 30 days before there could be, and we have tried to exercise the nimbleness to address even having day passes or having people that show up just for the day to follow a member, to be nimble enough to allow for that. This gives us the administrative period of time to collect, gather that information, compile it in the book for review, and then to try to get it in timely fashion on the members' desks upon the beginning of the actual session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lindquist, how many days do you think it would take your department or agency to review the applicants and give the approval?
Mr. Lindquist.
The review process, Senator Limmer, is not that part of the issue that's of concern. It's we have traditionally sent out an annual letter to the organizations that have normally covered the legislature, offered them the opportunity to submit these applications because there's a turnover in these agencies. And it's that compiling of data and getting the JPEG photos and all those things together to move into the compilation of this booklet that is the time-consuming piece. In this case, 30 days before the beginning of this legislative session would have roughly been, you know, mid first week of December. We had an awful lot of stuff going on. Wasn't a front burner issue, but at least that ball would be rolling and in the works at that point, per Senate rule.
Well, Madam Chair, I may want to direct our committee to the end of line 14 and then line 15, where we do place a time period to review the application and approve or reject it. The Sergeant of Arms must review the application and approve or reject within 14 days. So I think we aren't removing that language from this particular legislation. And all I'm trying to do is make sure it's that we have a certain respect for the press and that at least 30 days before is not necessarily needed at this time to satisfy that requirement.
Yeah. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I would support Senator Limmer's motion. I don't entirely feel comfortable with this whole section. I understand perhaps the logistical reason for it, but I think anything we can do that makes it less restrictive would be good, and I don't see a need to have this 30-day before the session convenes language in here. You know, if somebody wants to apply later, then they just don't get themselves in the book, and somebody can send us out an email saying there's another group that's been added, and pencil them in the back of your book.
All right. Well, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, the language as it's currently proposed, though, does actually put a limit on the amount of session credentials that are going to be issued. Because by the time the session starts, all the session credentials are going to be issued, and what's available then are day-to-days. How many people are we going to credential to come and go during the session freely if there's just no end date on when we quit issuing them? I kind of use, I guess, my question then.
Mr. Lindquist or...
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I guess my comment to that would be is we have accommodated historically people who have come during the course of the session, and certainly those people who come for a day, that has not been a problem. I think working from just memory, in 2010 the letter went out that we were requiring and asking that those applications be in by the 15th of December, so that was roughly a two-week period if the committee would be... I guess the application deadline, we would just like something that would be the authority to start that ball rolling and to have a period with some sort of a deadline that allows us for compilation of that material. So it's not in any way, shape, or form, in our mind, to be restrictive. It just simply allows that information to flow, but yet that there is a deadline when we expect that stuff to be turned in for the compiling of the booklet.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to look through any language that might be in our rules or something that may have been in the stricken language, but is there any reference to a 30-day before the first day of the legislative session reference in our existing rules now? There is not. So... why do we need the 30-day reference in the new language is what I'm getting at.
Sure. Similar, and I am. Senator Limmer, I am. I would tend to be. Oh, Spenda, do you want?
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think it's just simply to try to add some structure to what has been. Not a very structured process over the last years. You know, this the press credentialing and this entire process has worked quite well, except for this piece of what I'll just refer to as new media. And this is an effort to try to be inclusive and try to allow those people full participation. And the way we operate around here, it seems like we all work better with some sort of deadline. And if you're be more comfortable with a shorter deadline or no deadline, I'll assure you we'll make it work one way or the other.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, a legislative session is 2 years long, and also, so, you know, things might change between 1 year and the next in terms of who wants a pass or who the person would be that would be designated by the press organization to have it. So I think being silent on this is okay. I think, you know, it'll work out. And people still have to go through the sergeant's office to get a pass. And
Senator Limmer, too, I would, for members, on lines 12.10, on page 12, 12.10 to 12.13, there is, we do touch on the directory there. So, I mean, I think as long as if we wanted to maybe put in a 30-day language there, and so that people would have, so people that are credentialed would have a full understanding that, you know, without 30 days prior to session, they're not going to be in the book. But as Senator Berglund said, still could send out an email to members and let people know if there's a new applicant that's been accepted. That might, I mean, if there's, I don't know if Mr. Bonner can help us with that, but if there's, we do discuss the directory on page 12.10 to 12.13, so maybe if we just insert a 30-day requirement there, then that would give Mr. Lindquist, you know, the ability to, and then people would know that, well, then they're not in the book.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Mr. Lindquist.
We, with full understanding of the two-year cycle, we have annually published the book. The credential has been issued given the first year of the two-year biennium, but we revisit any additions or changes. So it's not like we do this once for a two-year session and do not revisit that, although at some point, point well taken by Senator Berglund, that an email could be sent out that another individual organization has been added to the credentialing. It doesn't seem practical to publish the book with Volume 1 and Volume 2 and as we go through a session.
No, so. Absolutely. Further discussion, Senator Sinjum.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, not to try to solve problems, but we're probably in a day when, you know, a website or, you know, some sort of electronic reference to this information is probably the way we ought to go anyway.
Sinjum. Thank you, Senator Sinjum. Any further discussion? All right, the members, again, the Limmer Amendment is online. Let me make sure I've got it right here. On line 11.14, to remove the words at least 30 days before the first day of the legislative session. All in favor of the Limmer Amendment, say aye.
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 And opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Lim. Senator Sinjum.
Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment.
A1? Side of the table needs it.
Thanks, Barb.
Thank you. Senator Sinjum, we're to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this particular amendment deals with budget targets and referencing page 4, line 9, it suggests that a sentence be added, as is noted in the on your sheet, that subsequent adjustments to those targets, if they're frankly necessary or deemed necessary, would be made by public announcement of the chair of the rules of Committee of Rules Administration. It's simply to allow an option, if you will, for a subsequent target if, upon going through this most difficult budget, it would appear that the initial targets weren't all that they might be in terms of just general accuracy. Now, this is going to be a difficult budget, Madam Chair, and we all know that, and some flexibility, you know, as we have it now, we have one set of targets. It's quite possible that some slight adjustment may be needed to the one or more of those targets along the way, and this would provide that.
Okay. Well, discussion?
Madam Chair, the targets refer to 15 days before the deadline. So once the deadline has passed, what the targets, I would assume, don't mean anything. Because the targets only apply to before the deadline. So I'm not sure why it's necessary.
Madam Chair,
I mean, unless you were going to do something, you did something 15 days before and then 5 days before you wanted to amend them, I guess. I guess you could do that, but I mean, I don't. We've ever done that, but.
Senator Sinjum.
Madam Chair, it's possible that that may be necessary, and that's the sense of this amendment.
Further discussion.
Just to provide some flexibility.
Further discussion on the A1?
Well.
Senator Bach.
I'm sure, does this then, so that this wouldn't actually then, I mean, what would the targets mean if once they're issued, there was the flexibility to be able to simply move them over the next 15 days until the committee deadline? mean, I guess why have targets if you can simply move them the next day or the next week?
Senator Sinchin?
Madam Chair, and I would just think, you know, I think the way this place operates, targets are fairly important for the committees to march forward with their work, and I think targets are issued with all the faith and confidence that anybody can put into them in terms of the fact that they may be and probably hopefully are the right targets, but this is, you know, if you will, a second chance. If upon deliberation by the committees it's deemed that we do need a target adjustment, we hope it doesn't happen, but if that's necessary, this amendment simply provides that flexibility. But I, you know, targets, I, you know, we certainly, targets are going to be presented by leadership here at the appropriate time, and they're going to be sincerely offered and well thought out. But who knows as we go through this process.
Madam.
Senator Bach?
Madam Chair, Senator Sinchin, why is the language permissive on line 1.3? Why do we use the word may? So does that mean you can change targets and not tell anybody under this?
Mm-hmm. Or is it permissive back to me? Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, perhaps one explanation is that it's in the event the subsequent adjustment is necessary, but I suppose you are correct. It is written in the permissive.
Madam Chair, I would orally be willing to make that a will.
Okay.
Shall.
All right. So on line 1.3, Senator Sinchin offers an amendment to the amendment that would read strike may and add shall. Discussions on the amendment to the amendment? All in favor, say aye.
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 And opposed? Amendment is adopted. Now we are back on the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, maybe counsel could just clarify for me. Does this language then only apply to the 15-day period prior to the committee deadline?
Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, the way the rule is currently written, I believe that's correct. You have the 15-day window that the targets are provided for, and the targets relate to the deadline. I'm looking at Rule 7.4 to 7.6 to ensure that I don't believe that the target that's announced there relates to any of those restrictions.
Further discussion? All right. So all in favor of Senator Sinchin, the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? A1 amendment is adopted. Further discussion on the rules? Senator Sinchin.
Chair, not unlike Senator Limmer, I have the A2 amendment.
You're doing better than Senator Limmer, though. Please.
Well,
Madam
so
Chair,
far.
I...
so far. All right, members, we're handing out the A2 amendment. All right, Senator Sinchin, to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this amendment is to replicate in committee what we already have on the Senate floor, and that is that within the sphere of putting together a budget in any particular area, we need to keep the overall budget within the framework of the targets. In the committee. Currently, that is not provided for within our rules. So it's simply to apply the same rules that we have on the floor relative to staying within the budget framework, the budget target framework, to the committee setting.
Discussion on the A2 amendment. All right, seeing no discussion.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, one of the things that confuses me about this is that there are bills that are heard in committee before budget targets are ever announced. So,
this,
you know, if you have an amendment to a bill that's being heard in Senator Hahn's committee, for example, today, then you wouldn't have a budget target to know if your amendment was in order or out of order. And that would be true, you know, for the author of their own bill. I mean, if they had an amendment and it was going to change a fiscal note.
Senator Berglund, I think this only applies to an omnibus appropriation bill, which is outlined in our rules. I don't know if that makes a difference to the question you're asking, but you'll note it says to an omnibus appropriation or tax bill.
So, Madam Chair, if a bill was being heard and laid over for possible consideration in an omnibus bill, that bill could be amended without regard to this rule if it was adopted?
Is that a policy?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I think that's correct. I don't think a bill taken up before the consideration of an omnibus bill would be covered by this rule.
So, Madam Chair, to that point, isn't that a way to get around the committee targets? I mean, if one of the committee chairs now decided to move some bills that cost money out of their committee to full finance, couldn't they then avoid their budget target by doing that? And some of that has happened, and I don't quite understand why it's happened, but some bills have been moved out of their divisions. I guess we don't call them divisions any longer, but moved out of their committees to full finance, and we haven't scored the money. Now, I would hope that whatever was sent out to cost money at some point would be included in whatever the committee's target is. But it's going to get, and I think we've had a number of members kind of bring that up in some of the committees, is who's keeping score here? What is the spreadsheet going to look like? Or are we going to have omnibus bills and finance is just going to roll it all together when it gets there? I think there's a little confusion about that right now, but this would be a way to avoid a budget target for a committee. That's how I would view it. Somebody can please correct me if I'm not reading.
That's a good question. So, Mr. Bodden, maybe you can help us. Under current rule, this is not the first time we've seen bills with fiscal notes move. So how is it currently handled in the end with budget? How has it been handled in the past with budget targets? Still, the budget target for the committee is the budget target for the committee.
Madam Chair, I don't know that the publicly announced targets under Rule 7.2 have restricted committee activity on omnibus bills in terms of net appropriations or revenues. But again, if you look to the subsequent rules, 7.4 through 7.6, that's, I guess, you know, in a way they relate to those targets because as the bill comes out of committee, that kind of, the finance committee, that would lock in the amount of appropriation or revenue that's contained in those bills as the target. I think in the past, if it helps, I think Rule 7.2 has been intended as a convenience and a way to kind of frame the discussion publicly on what the targets will be.
Mm-hmm. Senator Sinjum.
Madam Chair, I was just thinking that as we put that target together, whatever that number is, that, you know, that package of expenditures related to that program area, that's the target, irrespective of, and this is going to differ with council, irrespective if it's an omnibus bill or any other bill. that if we have $10 billion to spend in a certain area, that's what we got to spend, no matter if it's an individual bill or if it's an omnibus bill. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I don't think council agrees with that.
Madam Chair, and Senator Sendrum, you can only spend a dollar once. I wouldn't disagree with that.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sendrum, you know, there's a difference between being able to offer an amendment and having an amendment pass. And, you know, I don't think this amendment to the rules is needed.
Senator Limmer.
I'm looking at the wording of this. I'm not sure if this makes sense to me. On line 4 of the amendment, it talks about the amendment as being out of order if, number one, it will increase net appropriations from or reduce net revenue in excess of. I don't know how you reduce net revenue in excess of the current budget target. That doesn't seem to make sense to me. If you're reducing the net revenue in excess of the current budget target, maybe it's just the way I'm reading it. If the question I'm getting at is, let's say you had a budget target of that $10 billion, would this prevent a committee from bringing in an amendment that spends less than the $10 billion? Is that also restricted? And then does it impede perhaps a savings of taxpayer money? Or does it have to fall directly on the target?
Mr. Limmer, Senator Limmer, good question. Senator, Mr. Potter, we don't want
to. Madam Chair and Senator Limmer.
Can't imagine a chair going under their budget target, Senator Limmer, but
it's a new day, Madam Chair.
New day.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I would concur with the chair's reading. I don't think it prevents spending less than the budget target.
All right.
And in the same regard, I mean, I think it's treating reductions in net revenue as kind of tax expenditures.
Okay. All right.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
I'm sure I'll just try one more time because I've been a committee chair and I've had to offer amendments to my bill after the targets were announced and before the bill passed the committee. And I would just challenge anybody to go back and look at any of those amendments and tell me if anybody else could have ruled whether it was going to meet this rule or not. I mean, I still had an obligation at the end of the day to make sure the bill was within the target that was announced. But to say an amendment can't be offered because somebody might raise a rule that it's not allowed under the rules, I think could be used to play a lot of mischief with people's amendments. Hmm.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, and to Senator Berglund's point, I could see where it could be difficult if you're talking about an amendment that doesn't necessarily have a clear fiscal note attached, where what you're doing is changing the language that might have financial implications, but you might not know when you adopt that policy correction or adjustment. I could see that, but I want to speak in favor of the amendment because it would protect the fiscal integrity of the target. And that's what we're talking about right now is the concern that we could be talking about proposals that would take the committee way outside of the target, and you're trying to maintain that target and help the chairs and the committees adopt bills that we can afford within the structure of what we're, you know, what our budget is. So if we're trying to keep the structure, we're trying to maintain the financial integrity, if you know that the fiscal note is going to jeopardize that, I would think that the chair could rule that amendment out of order. But if you don't know, then I would say that you would be, you know, this probably would not come into play because you wouldn't know whether it has a fiscal impact or not.
Further discussion, Senator Sendrum.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking if a member had a amendment in committee to increase something, might they also then just frame up that amendment in such a fashion that within the same framework of the committee it would decrease something else equally or at least at whatever level. I think it can work that way.
Mr. Bodden?
I mean, just to, again, Madam Chair, just to stay within, as Senator Ortman has pointed out, the budget target.
Madam Chair and Senator Sanders, I'm not sure I completely understand how you would like to change the language of the amendment.
Oh, no, he's not.
No, I'm just being hypothetical here in terms of, Madam Chair, Mr. Bonner,
Senator,
how this would, how this could work and probably should work within the committee.
Same as on the floor.
You could shift to an amendment
if you offset it somewhere else.
That's why it says net. Right.
Yes.
Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, the key point is, and the key word is net. I think the intention is to make sure that it's kept level. So if there's an intention to spend money, additional funds elsewhere, then it would need to provide additional revenue for that purpose or cut spending elsewhere within the bill.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just worried that, you know, in order to offer an amendment, everybody's going to have to get every amendment they have drafted fiscal noted, and I know that's not possible to do. And some of you who've been here a little while know that's not possible to do either, because, you know, sometimes you can't even get fiscal notes for the bills in time for the time you want to hear the bill in a committee. So I just worry that this is a way to make it impossible for people to offer amendments that should be offered and considered by a committee.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
For Senator Senjum, Senator Senjum on line 1-3, are you trying to restrict this to just omnibus appropriation and just an omnibus tax bill?
Madam Chair, Senator, at this point,
that's the
language of the amendment, yeah.
I'm just reading that as, I'm wondering if we should include omnibus in front of tax bill. I don't know if that's defined.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
We heard a number of tax bills today.
Yeah.
Senator Hartman, and I don't think you mean any tax bill.
No,
okay. Senator Senjum, you could just would you like to incorporate that as part of your motion?
Madam Chair and Senator Michelle and perhaps Senator Ortman, the notion of placing omnibus in front of tax would be an improvement or clarification. I would offer that amendment if I'm sensing that.
We'll just incorporate it as part of the A2 amendment. Excellent. Further discussion on the A2.
Well,
Senator Bach.
I share Senator Berglund's concern. This would preempt even the smallest amendment that might have very little fiscal impact that we don't have a note on. Could even be an oral amendment that everybody agrees we should make in committee, because it may have a fiscal note, could preempt even the smallest changes as we're trying to get an omnibus bill put together.
Right.
We've always given committees some latitude to do their work, and that's the finance committee's the last stop for those appropriation bills, and they kind of do the final tracking, but I mean, you may not be able to do the best work in committee if this is adopted, I think.
All right. Senator Senjum.
Again, Madam Chair, this is simply offered to try to maintain the integrity of the target. My hope would be that we could move ahead and try it if it doesn't work. That's why we have a rules committee.
The discussion. All right, then I guess the A2 amendment incorporated with the omnibus tax bill language incorporated. Senator Senjum moves the A2 amendment. All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
No.
No.
Motion is adopted. Further discussion on the rules. Further discussion on the rules.
I'm sure I think
Senator Bach?
Council's got some suggested language on the dress code issue that was brought to us for some of the fine work of our staff of the Senate.
So on page 12, members, lines 12.3 to 12.32, Mr. Bodern, suggested language.
So, Madam Chair, one suggestion would be to restrict the application of the dress code, and you could do that as follows on page 12, line 30. Delete all persons and insert legislators, legislative employees, and individuals with credentials issued under Rule 16 who are, so that the that everything that follows would apply only to those individuals.
Senator Bach, would you like to make that motion?
Madam Chair, I would. I'll offer Council's oral amendment on line 12.3.
So members, does everyone understand?
No, Senator Madam Fishbar? Chair, could we repeat that?
Mr. Bonner, would you repeat it, please?
Madam Chair, I can maybe the best way to do it is just to start by reading the way the new sentence would read. Legislators, legislative employees, and individuals with credentials issued under Rule 16 who are present on the Senate floor during floor proceedings shall wear appropriate business attire.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, how does that
Senator Gerlach.
How does that get at the issue of Senator Limmer's ties?
Senator Gerlach, that will be another amendment if you'd like to work with council. Any further
And Madam Chair,
discussion?
I'm just, do we feel like this gets everybody we need to get, I guess, you know, as we do it on the fly? Just want to make sure.
Legislators, legislative employees.
Legislative.
Credentials, so that would be press, Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Okay. If you want to look at the complete list of people who would have access to the Senate floor and think about that. I mean, that's contained within Rule 17, but I think you've picked up the significant individuals that way.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
We sometimes, on the first day of session, swearing in day, we allow family, let's say, to attend. How does this amendment or even the existing language dictate the dress code to family that may accompany senators?
Mr. Limmer, I don't think it would apply.
I think the amendment takes care of it.
Mm-hmm. So a son of a senator has to wear a tie or not wear a tie?
Not Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer, so it would strictly be legislators, legislative employees, and those under Rule 16?
Correct.
So would not apply to family members then. So. Senator Limmer, are you there? Yes, Senator Fishbach.
I feel like we're opening it a little wide because we were looking at our very specific, the chaplain who may be wearing a clerical collar or the, we'll live with it, but I just think that now we're pretty much anybody who's not a legislator or legislative employee or someone with credentials is exempt at all times. Riff-raff. You know what is?
Madam Chair, Senator Fishbach, how do they get on the floor? Who are those other people?
Well, I'm just saying that we're making a wide exception for a narrow something that we wanted.
I could
now we don't require any of our guests. I mean anyone who is permitted.
Senator Limmer,
Madam Chair, I just wanted to address Senator Gerlach that I have extra ties for anybody that may need an extra tie.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, I think we've come a long way from where we were. Senator Fishbach.
All right. Further discussion? Everyone understand the Bach oral amendment? So all those in favor of Senator Bach's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Yeah.
Any other further discussion?
Madam Chair, we discussed whether when the Ethics Committee is in executive session, whether
yes.
The reporting requirement.
And Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I thought
Senator
that
Fishbach.
Was specifically when you were talking about the employees. There's an ethical conduct, but this was where we added the language was specifically to employee.
54.5.
I think it's where we had that discussion, Madam Chair, Senator Bach.
Senator Fishbach, you're saying this only applies to the employee if an employee is being, not for members,
Madam
but an
Chair,
employee.
Yes. This comes under, Madam Chair, this comes under
Senator Fishbach.
Rule 54, employees. And Madam Chair, under the ethical the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct already has the ability to go into executive session here under the we were just allowing the committee that dealt with the employee discipline to have the opportunity to. They don't have to, but they could if they needed to, if it was something in particular that was very sensitive or before they found probable cause or something, to be able to use executive session. So this new language only applied to employees. So I hope that's why I was trying to.
No, I'm aware of that.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
I was just wondering, is there a requirement that that executive session be recorded or not? I think that's kind of the question.
Okay. Senator Berglund, you had your...
I don't know that it matters. I mean, there's always a first time for everything, but I've been here 37 years, and I've never seen a disciplinary matter involving a Senate employee brought before the Rules Committee. It's always been taken care of outside of the Rules Committee.
Mr. Bodder?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I was discussing something with Senator Bach. I didn't...
Oh, no, I don't think to Senator Burke, but Senator Bach, is there some language you'd like to see, or?
Well,
Mr. Bodder,
what does counsel think about the issue that I raised, I guess? Is if he has some suggested language, I'm open to consider offering something.
Madam Chair and Senator Bach, I think the question
Mr. Bodder.
Is whether the proceeding would be recorded electronically, and I think the Senate, there is a handbook of Senate policies and procedures that provides some more direction on how committee hearings have to be dealt with. It's not part of the rules, but it is. It governs how the Senate operates, and it would require recording the meeting. The one possible question here is what disposition the committee would want to make of the recording, whether it should be specified. That should be kept confidential.
And currently, Mr. Bodern, the committee responsible would designate what would happen where the recording would be,
Madam
the
Chair,
disposition of the recording?
I think that's the custom and practice. That's how it's been handled in the past, at least with respect to the Subcommittee on Ethical Conduct.
There. Further discussion on the rules? All right. Seeing none, then we need to have a motion to adopt permanent rules?
Or can we move to adopt? It should be introduced as a committee resolution.
So, members, what we would do is move. I'd accept a motion to adopt, and then that will be put into a resolution and brought to the floor. So, all in favor of the permanent rules, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you, Senator Bach. Oh, yes, and members, I'm going to adjourn the Rules Committee, but I will need the committee on the committees for just a moment. So, rules is adjourned, and committee on committees, if you could please.